start with. I think I'll just read it again just so that I remember what it is too. Suppose for the sake of argument that quantum theory is not fundamental, it is a first order or equilibrium approximation to something, and quantizing gravity is inappropriate. One, is there evidence for or against this? Two, what implications does this have for the problems discussed at this conference?
Yeah, so I thought to make a few comments on this. Is this on? Yeah, so one, I've always been impressed that there was not an obvious experimental argument for quantizing the gravitational field as there is for quantizing the electromagnetic field. I have in mind the argument about the ultraviolet catastrophe, which you just have to make, and then you realize that there has to be something like quantum quanta of the electromagnetic field. And the same argument, you can attempt to make it in the context of general relativity, and the argument fails because a system of gravitational radiation will not come to thermal equilibrium in any finite time in any system that you can devise satisfying the positive energy conditions of the energy momentum tensor. So that's a little hint. I think it's there are quantum gravity, there are experiments that test the quantization of the gravitational field coming. One that's sometimes mentioned has to do with tensor modes in inflation. If you believe that inflation is the correct explanation, the standard explanation of inflation is the correct explanation for the scalar modes of the cosmic microwave background, then that is a genuine quantum effect. That is, it's the amplification of the quantum. Bill is saying no, so he can comment. There's an amplification of the quantum fluctuations of the scalar field. And if you believe that there are at least linearized modes of the gravitational field that also have vacuum fluctuations, they should be there and they should be suppressed relative to the scalar modes by roughly the inflation scale and Planck units. And therefore, they should be there at a level that the Planck satellite can see. So that's simultaneously a test of inflation and quantum gravity. So it's not a pure test, but if they're not seen, then either there are not quantized quantum fluctuations of the linearized gravitational field or standard inflation is wrong. So I think that's an interesting, that there are such tests coming. And a last comment, I mean, various people have said things like, you know, well, there's no progress in quantum gravity and, you know, nothing has been done in quantum gravity. I want to stand up for a lot of work which has been done in quantum gravity. I think there's been a lot of progress in quantum gravity, and I think the import of the last sentence is very much to the point. That is, I would say the major issues which are outstanding in different approaches to quantum gravity are precisely those at the intersection of quantum theory and time. If one doesn't care about getting precisely those issues right, then there's been a lot of progress, I think, as Raphael discussed from some points of view and could be discussed from other points of view. There's been a lot of progress on a number of different approaches to quantum gravity, but the hard problems that are faced remain the issues which are the subject of this conference.
There's a comment.
Yeah, just in terms of evidence for it, I've always thought of, say, the holographic principle or the Hartle-Hawking formula as, or the Hawking radiation formula as evidence for it in some sense. Could you comment on that, whether that's a correct impression or whether maybe that's just misleading?
I think the whole world, and maybe Bill would want to comment on this, I mean, the whole world of results around black hole thermodynamics, Hawking radiation, Unruh radiation, etc., has been hinting to us for 30 more years that there is some fundamental connection between statistical physics, quantum physics, and space-time. And I think that that we do not have deeper wisdom about that. That is, that there's a sense that has been present, and I get every time I go back and I study or teach those papers, that there is, Phil, I don't know if you, there's something that's hinted at in all of that work that so far has still not been realized.
Yeah, I agree. It's still very mysterious, but the fact that all of these things sort of seem to be fitting together. In some sense, the thermal radiation is almost not the most surprising thing that turns out to be present in, you can make little analog models. I mean, it'd be nice to actually see them, but, you know, if you have a waterfall echo supersonic, then you expect to get thermal radiation being given off by that sonic horizon. With a temperature there, not proportional to the mass, obviously, but proportional to the rate of change or velocity as you go through there. The key thing about black holes is that that temperature, that structure near the horizon, which determines the temperature, is exactly the same structure that determines the energy of the system. So you have this link between temperature and energy. And that then, of course, immediately leads you to an entropy, just by the sort of simplest, straightforward application of the laws of thermodynamics. And that's sort of where the real surprise comes in, and that's where everybody is still trying to figure out what in the world is going on there and why that's true, and whether or not, you know, the information paradox, which all the particle physicists think are solved, but I'm still in a minority who thinks it's still far from solved. Maybe I'm part of Kuhn's
unreconstructed.
Yes. The people that have to die off, you know, before the
degressing research program.
Who have to die off before the new paradigm gets accepted. I don't think so, but there is still certainly a mystery there. The reason I shook my head about the quantum fluctuations is, in a sense, any fluctuations would give you get amplified by the expansion of the universe. The big thing about the inflationary one is that after they get amplified, the Hubble radius increases again so that they can actually become dynamic again. I mean, even in an ordinary, non-inflationary universe, if you look at long wavelength fluctuations, they're amplified by the expansion of the universe. The trouble is they always stay long wavelength. They never become dynamic again. And in inflation, they become dynamic again and presumably are the ones that we see around us. But it's basically any fluctuation that gets amplified. Now, the sort of favorite, most compelling, whatever words you want to use, is that these are actually quantum fluctuations that are being amplified. And you can make arguments that, you know, if they were thermal fluctuations, they should get redshifted and disappear. On the other hand, these all depend on things dropping out of the Planck scale. So all of these fluctuations were super Planck, which in the gravity regime means they were singularities. I mean, if you take the nonlinearities of gravity at all seriously, then a super Planck fluctuation is a singularity. And so it's just in the linearized regime where you can approximate it by as if it were a fluctuation on a background. So whatever is coming out of that highly singular quantum regime, maybe it's vacuum fluctuations, maybe it's something else that we have no idea about. So it could be, you know, some kind of regime which is not a quantum regime, is a classical regime, but somehow or other that highly singular junk at the beginning produces some fluctuations which would then produce these tensor modes, for example. So they certainly aren't one can interpret them as quantum, as evidence for quantum gravity, but that's certainly not necessary. And the problem is it all depends on really accepting inflation as well. And, you know, if you accept enough tooth fairies, you can amass as big a fortune as you want, but...
Any other comment on this thread, or shall we go to another one? Yeah. oh, this person cheated. It says, go to back.
Yeah, it's a two-sided question.
It says, Roddy Tomoka has an answer for how long a particle is in a barrier. It is given by Bohmian mechanics, but it is not directly observable. It's only inferred from the theory. Bill Unruh has an answer to the same question that comes from his own theory. All particles spend exactly 7 seconds in barriers, but that is not independent. But that is not independently observable as well. Without independent observability, what makes one theory science and the other fantasy? Why are they both not just counting angels on the head of a needle?
They are.
Okay.
Look, it's your question.
Bohmian mechanics says a lot of things, some of which are observable and some are not. It makes predictions, such as that the planets will approximately move along Kepler ellipses. It predicts spectral lines. It predicts outcomes for EPR experiments. And it also makes statements about things that are not observable. Now, that seems like a very normal situation for a physical theory. If you take Schrödinger's equation seriously, it will also tell you a lot of things that are very hard, if at all, observable. It gives you every detail about how the wave function evolves. And so it's actually not surprising that a physical theory will also say things that are not observable. The other example, the sort of theory or toy theory that every particle spends 7 seconds inside the barrier, that, well, actually says nothing otherwise. So actually there is no advantage that this theory brings, whereas Bohmian mechanics, of course, explains all phenomena of non-relativistic quantum mechanics. I would say that's a crucial difference.
Well, I mean, the reason I came up with that off-the-wall theory was simply to point out that if a prediction of a theory is not testable, then I don't think it means very much. And especially, I mean, this came in response to a comment where he said that if you actually try and measure the time of barrier penetration by sort of attaching a clock or something like that, you get a different answer than the Bohmian answer. At that point, I mean, I don't know if that's true. I haven't done that calculation. I've done the quantum calculation of barrier penetration and so forth. But as soon as that becomes true, where any measurement that you make gives you a different answer, I believe that that answer that you're getting is just nonsense. And, you know, in the Schrödinger case, the system, there may be experiments that are extremely hard to do. But if they're going to be sensible physics, they should be at least in principle doable. If you can show that they are even in principle not doable, which is what I argued as far as unitarity of black hole evolution, that even in principle, you would never be able to do the interference experiments that were necessary to test that unitary evolution, then I believe that that does tell you something about the theory and that that's an aspect of the theory that's just straight wrong. And that you should be altering your theory if the theory is predicting things that are in principle unobservable. So it's sort of part of my philosophical feeling about how theories should behave. That their predictions, if they're going to say that they are predictions, should be predictions about physical things, about physical observables. Yeah, I don't mind theories having ideal elements that aren't in and of themselves observable, but they aren't part of the predictions of the theory.
Yeah, let me directly react to that. Something you said about when you measure it, you get a different result. Well, that's is not really on target. It's the point is you can't actually measure how long the particle stays inside the barrier, except when you detect it when entering the barrier, detect it when exiting the barrier. But as we all know, this detection when the particle enters the barrier will drastically change the particle's wave function, and therefore change the future behavior. So this is, it's in the nature of the question that you cannot directly test it. And well, those things that you can directly measure, for example, you know up to a certain inaccuracy the time when the particle enters the barrier, you measure the time when the particle exits the barrier, well, that comes out right and with reasonable values. And these values are indeed in agreement with the time that Bohmian mechanics asserts as the dwelling time inside the barrier. About sort of the general picture of what a physical theory should or should not say, well, I guess we simply have a philosophical disagreement about that. I think it's absolutely okay for a physical theory to have some implications that we cannot test. If a physical theory tells us something about what happens inside a black hole after some matter crossed the horizon, I wouldn't say that's unreasonable of a physical theory just because you can't observe it. If a theory tells us what would have happened if at some time near the Big Bang the conditions had been very different from what they have actually been, well, that's not, I think, a reason for dismissing the theory.
Yeah. You can respond to that?
I think there's somewhat of a middle position. I think I agree completely with your statement that if a theory makes statements about situations which are in principle unobservable, that should not be a reason to discard the theory. It's not a failure of theory to do something like that. However, I also think it's not a big advantage. It's not something to cheer about. It's not something that will make this theory superior to any other theory. It's not a major feat to be able to make a prediction about something which is in principle unobservable. And as far as I know, you mentioned these calculations. There's an easy way to see that this is indeed the case about the tunneling times in the Bohmian theory, although we have to distinguish between the dwell time and the transition time and the reflection time, depending on whether the particle goes through the barrier or enters it and comes out at the same side. These times that you can easily calculate from the Bohmian trajectories, and you can form an average over an ensemble Bohmian trajectories, and then you find that although they depend on the wave function, these averages are not bilinear functionals of the wave function, which means that either directly or indirectly, I mean, any measurement in quantum mechanics, the expectation of an observable, whether it be self-adjoint or POVM, is going to be a bilinear function of the wave function. And these transition times are not. And this means that there is no observable whatsoever in quantum theory for which these can be the expectation value.
Exactly. That is a different way of looking at what I said before.
Yeah.
I'd like to add another remark. That's, I think for the question of whether it is kind of okay or in the scientific spirit for a theory to make statements about unobservable things, I think it also plays a role whether the unobservability is sort of put in by hand, is kind of ad hoc, or just comes out of the of the defining equations of the theory. So, for example, if I postulated angels on the tip of a needle, and also added the postulate that will be able to observe them. That's sort of an ad hoc. I don't give any particular reasons for why that be so. It's kind of contrived, conspiratorial. Whereas if I propose a set of 2-3 differential equations, and it follows from an analysis of these equations that it's not possible to observe certain features of that universe that comes out as a solution of these equations for inhabitants of that universe, I would say the status is different then. It's not conspiratorial. It's just one of the consequences of the theory.
Angels on the head of a pin is probably a particularly unfortunate example for you to take, because it was, in fact, came out of very serious concerns of the relationship between the sacred and the physical in the discussions between the theologians of the 12th and 13th centuries. They had very definite ideas about what the relationship was, and these were really solid attempts on their part to try and look at what that relationship was. How does one relate angels, which are part of the sacred sphere, to the physical sphere? So I think that's
unfortunate. Did they have equations for the angels?
Not all science is equations.
But equations are an indication of sort of higher degree of precision, concreteness, and accuracy.
I think in the interest of getting to more than two questions. Well, we have one constraint, and that is Lee is leaving very soon. So I tell you what, we can always come back to this, time permitting. Fair enough. I think it's a passionate discussion. So this one apparently needs to be read in front of Lee. Hope it's not insulting. What is the most fundamental law of nature? And by the way, what is a law?
And I chose that. I'm spending the weekend with Lee and looking forward to some discussions about this. And it's my reaction to his talk this morning. I thought actually Joe Henson put his finger on the problem with Lee's position about the need for a meta-law behind all this. And I would say that there is a most fundamental law of nature. Well, it goes back to the quotation I gave at the start of the conference from Shakespeare's King Lear. Nothing will come of nothing. So my first fundamental meta-law is there must be something. And secondly, if we're going to do any science with it, it must be differentiated. That something must have structure in it. And that seems to me the meta law for us to do anything. And then, by the way, what is a law? Well, we have lots of examples of that. I would like just to mention, because I think it's very beautiful and it's not well known enough, what I would regard as the first really fundamental discovery in science. This was made by the Greek astronomers Hipparchus and Ptolemy, 150 BC and 150 AD, respectively. On the sky is differentiated, so that satisfies my, and it's there, so that's my two meta laws satisfied. The ancient Greeks saw these bright lights moving across the sky, the various planets, the sun and the moon. And they were very struck by the fact that their motions seemed to be fairly regular as measured by the rotation of the stars, the rising and setting of the stars. But on top of that, there were strange anomalies, odd movements, retrograde motions. And they set about trying to find an explanation for it. A law is ultimately an explanation for phenomena. And it's particularly the case when there are sort of oddities in the phenomena. And The observational fact they had was two-dimensional motions. The sky is two-dimensional. And they postulated to explain these things an extra dimension for these objects. They allowed them to move in the third dimension. And secondly, they postulated certain regularities in that third dimension, above all that the motion that they're moving uniformly on circles, and that all that irregularity is due to a projection onto the sky. And in case you don't know it, Ptolemy actually made a fantastically important discovery, which was the precursor of, well, both of Kepler, he made two discoveries, really, that was the precursor of both of Kepler's first two laws. There is an incredibly accurate anticipation of Kepler's second law due to Ptolemy. And this came from the simple fact of trying to explain phenomena. So that's what I would say is a good example of a law. Another one, of course, is Newton's, where he finally he postulated various things, but the key final breakthrough was that he took seriously the idea of centripetal forces and the law of universal gravitation. That was something which was not visible. He did it with great reluctance and emphasized that it's only mathematical, but then he was able to explain no end of things. So I think that's what is a law, and I think my fundamental law, the meta-law behind it all, is summed up in those two things. There must be something, and that something must be differentiated.
Question out there. Maybe I can, in the meantime, ask Lee, can the most fundamental law evolve? And if the most fundamental law is Julian's, that there's something there, does that mean that it would evolve into the law that there's nothing there?
I always learn from Julian, so I don't have much to add, except part of what I think is the lesson for me of the work that I presented is the following, that when we have a metaphysical prejudice, and it's very pervasive in physical sciences, that the more fundamental means the more timeless. We have a proclivity for Platonism. We have this idea that it's a very ancient thing, that the experience of the world as we have it is an illusion. Behind the illusion is something more fundamental and more permanent, and ultimately timeless. And it occurs to me more and more strongly that this is a beautiful vision which motivates most of the work we do, but it's a metaphysical vision. It's not necessary for science. It's a particular philosophical or metaphysical view which has colored how we've approached science and led to a great deal of success, but that's all it is. So one of the ways I see the project that I was discussing is what could physics and cosmology look like with this metaphysical presumption removed. And that's why it's intentionally a little bit provocative. It may be in the end there is a meta law. Maybe in the end there just is a fundamental law, period. Or it may be the laws evolved and there is a meta law. But it may be that the desire for a meta law, if you accept that laws evolve, is motivated by a metaphysical and philosophical proclivity, which is very attractive to us, but that's all it is. And therefore, the advance of science may have to dispense with it sometime in the future.
Can I add something to that discussion? In a sense, I've also been wondering what exactly a law is, and in context of your talk. In most of the theories of physics that we know, there, you have some phase space and some point in there which represents the state of a system, and then there are equations, and this, of course, and these we count as the laws, equations of motion, and of course, you are very right to say this whole way of dividing up things into initial conditions and then equations that govern the evolution is typically Newtonian and may be replaced by something else. That's very, maybe, in, well, you can also think perhaps of an action principle or any other way of stating how the anything that codifies the laws of physics. But even so, I would presume that laws are mathematical constructs. And they might be taken to be Platonic, which is a prejudice, of course. You might have another view of mathematics, the philosophy of mathematics, maybe intuitionistic or constructivistic. But still, it would seem to me that mathematical constructs, however you take them, are very different from physical objects. And so I have some difficulty in imagining the laws to be inhabiting space and time, that as if they were just like physical systems that would evolve there. So for me, mathematical statements are more or less tenseless. And to say that there is a law of a particular theory and it's given once and for all is different from saying that that law is eternal. And to say that, for example, you have a law that says that the speed of light is variable is different from saying that the law are evolving. Because I have difficulty in understanding how the laws themselves could be subject to time as if they were part of the universe, as if they were sensitive to interactions with other inhabitants of the universe, presumably physical systems. I don't think there are. You could have a law that says that the geometry is a dynamical object and that is sensitive to interactions with matter, but that doesn't mean that the laws themselves are evolving. So I hope you... That simply depends on the choice of a theory. There's laws of one theory and there's laws of another theory. They may contradict each other, but it doesn't mean that there has been an impact on the laws of that there were laws of Euclidean geometry and then suddenly something happened to them by some causal account that made them evolve into something else, just like, say, a comet plunged into the earth and made all the dinosaurs die out.
In this case, something did happen. What would be a cleaner case if space time had been swept, got globally, and then became Earth? But what really happened is that
we
became aware of
our
surroundings in space time and became Earth.
Yes,
so we. What would have happened the other way? It would have been a cleaner, funny case of something that was literally
Yes, but that seems, well, I would say that that's just, I mean, there's an historical development in physics in which we progress from one theory to another, and so on. But that's not the same thing as saying that the laws evolve. Mm-hmm. It's just that physics as a human project evolves.
About the two principles, that there is something and that it is somehow differentiable or that there's some...
Differentiated.
You may know there's a small book that starts exactly at this place, from nothing, the first distinction, and then further distinctions trying to create logic and then all of mathematics. Do you know what I'm referring to?
Yes, I think I know the book, yes, and I quite like it.
Spencer Brown's Laws of Form?
No, not that. I don't know that one.
Okay, it's often considered a crank little work, but it does start at this very, very basic place, and personally I recommend it to people who want to think about the fundamentals of mathematics and perhaps physics as well. Now, with respect to the question of whether mathematics is physics or not, and the connection, there's the interesting claim that's often made that mathematical expressions don't have any time in them, they just sort of lie there.
They're tenseless.
They're tenseless and so on. In the Spencer Brown book, in Laws of Form, he introduces self-referring expressions and shows how they generate time. Paradoxical expressions in particular generate waveforms, and the more general version of that, or the generalization of that, is imaginary numbers, which are generated by complex expressions referring to themselves. Anyway, one could get rid of that objection, and a good starting place is what's in this book, I guess.
Probably I'll go to the next question.
Yeah, but first, I'm curious, which book did you have in mind?
I can't remember. I've got it at home somewhere. Send me an email and I'll try and find it. And it sounded like it.
The next question is quantum theory sufficiently radical with respect to time? That sounds like Lucy and Hardy. A stopped clock is...
Right
twice a day. How many times a day is a stopped quantum clock right?
the answer I would give in the last one is probably never. I mean, that's one of the differences between the classical and the quantum, that if you have A and B, if you've got a motion of something that is and is through time, that if it goes from A to B, it has to go through all points in between. So with a clock, you know that if it's, or with time, you know that if it's A and then the time is B, that it has to cover all of those intervals in between. But we know with a clock, and I don't know what a stop quantum clock is, no Hamiltonian, I guess. But if I read the pointer, that pointer can jump all over the place under the influence of just of my reading it. And that sort of ties in with, is quantum mechanics radical enough? And I don't think it is. There is a sort of tension between time and quantum mechanics that comes into the whole problem of quantum gravity. One of the key laws of quantum mechanics is the law of probability, that if you have exclusive events, the probabilities of those exclusive events should add up to one. But of course, events are exclusive only at an instant of time. And if you don't have a good handle on what an instant of time is, you don't have a good handle on what exclusivity is, and you don't any longer have a good handle on, you know, what the probabilities should add up to one, the probabilities of what should add up to one. And this is the whole unitarity issue that, of course, particle physicists, I think, go through some secret Mithraithian ceremony with bull's blood poured over their heads in which they have to swear loyalty to the unitarity principle.
Is this being recorded? I shall watch this with pleasure again.
But, you know, and I suspect that when we come up with a quantum theory of gravity, that's just going to fall by the wayside. The problem, of course, is what in the world do you replace it with? If you have a probabilistic stochastic theory, you know, the sums of probabilities is one of the little things that you hope to be able to hang on to. The fact that something happens, which is the statement that the total probabilities are one, is something you want to hang on to. I guess here you at least get the extra thing that exclusivity, if they're not exclusive, then many things can happen. And so again, the sums of the individuals don't have to add up to one. So I think our concepts of time and our concept of quantum mechanics, a stochastic theory, a theory in which you have insufficient cause, and yet in which you still have laws which determine how you go from one situation to the other, that's something we're going to have to hang on to in quantum mechanics, but the detailed features of quantum mechanics that we work on now seem to be too closely tied with this notion of time, you know, an instant of time in which incompatible things can happen. And that needs to be generalized.
Could I just perhaps remark about incompatibility of things? I would say the instants of time, in my view, are incompatible. For me, a complete configuration of the universe is an instant of time. and they're all different by definition. So that's my comment on that one. I think, could I just make a remark? I was saying to Adrian Kent, one of the things that worries me about the discussions we've had this week is that there seem to be, I think, altogether 8 things that are really in play, and people are not really very good at distinguishing. First of all, there are 4 fundamental spaces that occur in physics: configuration space, phase space, space-time, and Hilbert space. There is classical physics and there is quantum physics. There is the complete universe and there are subsystems. And I think you have to think very, very carefully which one you're talking about and be very precise about it. I think a lot of people are talking about quantum mechanics, which is defined, the Schrödinger wave equation is defined on configuration space, and then they blithely talk about black holes, which are concepts in complete space-time. I just cannot understand talk about black holes in quantum gravity. It seems to me a contradiction almost. So that's a point I would like to make.
The black hole will no longer exist in quantum gravity.
I suspect it's an emergent thing, like so many emergent, other things will have to be.
Oh, but it would exist as an emergent concept.
Beg your pardon?
You're saying it would be there as an emergent concept. But that's
it's no different
from space-time itself in many approaches to quantum gravity. Of course, the black hole, being an aspect of space-time, will be there as an emergent concept.
Yes.
If space-time itself is emergent. I thought you were saying that the notion of black hole didn't make sense because you can't detect it in space, and it involves this temporal aspect, essentially. That was effectively my critique of canonical quantum gravity. We need to be able to talk about black holes, and if we can't, then there's something wrong with that approach.
I wouldn't agree there necessarily, no. If we can explain our observations, our classical observations that tell us that there's a black hole in the center of our galaxy, but we do this from a very fundamental theory in which there is no notion of black hole in the foundation of it, we have still got an explanation for the phenomena. If your theory, the Greeks said it, a theory is to save the appearances. You have phenomena, observations, which you want to explain. And that's all a theory has to do.
Well, that's another thing. I don't suppose I should answer that. That would get into the nature of theories and stuff, whether observations are truly independent of theories, which many people believe they're not.
Okay, let's go to the next one.
I've got a couple of related ones.
I would like to say, even before we get into gravity, which makes things much more complicated, I think it's very important to distinguish between things. And when you say classical physics and compare it with quantum physics and look at reversing things, I think there are 2 different classical physics that you should look at. The standard classical physics is completely reversible. But if you speak about the analysis of irreversible processes in classical physics, then we know that you smear things about in space-time and then you coarse grain, and then when you try to return from a coarse grain, you try to time reverse and you only have coarse-grained information, you're not going to hit your initial state correctly. So, and this appears to me to be much more comparable to quantum descriptions when these descriptions involve measurement, because the measurement is always irreversible. So when comparing quantum to classical, you have to be careful which classical you're comparing to.
I think I would accept that there's many more distinctions that one should probably keep an eye on, yes.
Michael?
You want to go to this one?
Yeah. I have a couple of stickers that all talk about the block universe as opposed to an evolving universe. And I can just say what my understanding of that, my opinion is. So on this, should I read it, or is this physical?
Yeah, could you read it?
Okay. The question is, what is the use of distinguishing the block universe from the evolving state? And there's a note added to the word use, saying use is meaning. And the second question is, could not any conceivable theory be written both ways? And I would think that the second question is a simple answer. The answer is yes. It's basically like this picture that Lee showed us. You have some quantity that evolves in time. And this is a more or less block universe view. And now if you add a preferred point, which you say is now, and you also assume that that now point is shifting all the way along in history, then you have an evolving state, evolving state point of view. And it seems obvious, at least in any kind of evolution of this kind, that you can add the point and you can also erase it and have an equivalent theory. So I would say that these are equivalent ways of expressing one and the same thing, and that there is no empirical distinction between them. But if you talk about use and meaning, then of course there's an intention in what you want to express, and that's grantedly completely metaphysical. And it's basically the difference between the A series and the B series of MacTaggart. It doesn't have any empirical use, but well, there are just two simple extreme views on the matter. One point of view is that this idea of having a preferred now or present is an illusion of our humans, our human experience, that there's no place whatsoever in physics. And then, of course, you would see this adding this point as a completely superfluous metaphysical addition to the theory that we should do away with and restrict ourselves to the more severe block universe point of view. And of course, the other extreme point of view is that no, this idea of a preferred present is something very real. It's not an illusion at all, but really it's a defect of our present physical theories that they didn't represent it. So from that point of view, you would say, no, our usual physical theories are drastically incomplete because they don't represent this preferred present, and we have to add that to the theories, not to make more predictions about experiments, but to complete our picture of the world. And so that's, I would say, is the only sense in which these two points of view make any difference.
Can I react to that?
Sure.
I'm a bit surprised that you said, immediately said, the answer to the second question is yes. Wouldn't you say there's a force pushing you to say no?
No.
With respect to relativity of simultaneity?
Oh,
wouldn't you think that if you want to have relativity of simultaneity and you're forced to the block universe?
That is actually another question. Maybe it's your question.
Yes.
So it says, if the fundamental reality is a succession... If the fundamental reality is a succession of moments of space, I think that's the idea of the progressing now, why do we observe relativity of simultaneity at scales where space-time curvature is negligible?
I didn't write it, but it's
no,
sort of
but,
the same
okay,
question,
so,
yeah.
So it's a question about this growing or progressing now and this relativity of simultaneity. I think these are really two distinct issues that can be compatible with each other in any way. So let's replace this by
the space-time diagram. So here's space-time, and I have some world lines, particles doing whatever they do. And now, the easiest way to represent that growing now is to take a hyperplane and let that move forward during the course of history. So that would, of course, introduce an absolute concept of simultaneity. This would be the Newtonian way to do it, because now I'm saying this is now, but this is also that's simultaneity. So yes, you can have absolute simultaneity in this theory of a progressing now. But it's not at all necessary. You could have any time slice. And moreover, you could suppose that this order of increasing now moments is only a complete ordering locally, but a partial ordering globally. So that here there's some progression, but here there might be a completely independent progression. And so in such a way that there is no absolute simultaneity between the now here and the now there.
This is something that I feel I don't understand. If you're a presentist, if you believe that the present moment is what's real and the past and the future are not real, well, wouldn't you have to make a choice then what belongs to the present and what not? Doesn't that commit you to a particular choice of foliation?
No, I think the easiest way in McTaggart's case is to have a scale that is completely ordered. So I can say exactly from all events in history which one occurred in the past, which one is occurring now, which one is occurring in the future. But it is possible to have some partial ordering structure in which the ordering is only given on a particular branch, but there is no fact of the matter whether this event here is simultaneous to that event there. So what I'm just trying to say is it's conceptually and mathematically completely possible to have a theory in which there is a progressing now, but there is no absolute simultaneity. These are distinct issues.
I think Belandu has something.
To continue, I don't buy your answer either to the first part of the question. In particular, I think the block universe is different from the evolving universe in a theory with insufficient cause, where things can simply happen as we know quantum mechanics works. So if you have things just happening, then there's a difference between the now before that thing has happened and the now after that thing has happened. And there's no way in which the block universe from before that you might want to construct is in any way the same as the block universe afterwards. So I think the two concepts are the same in a deterministic, classical kind of theory, but as soon as you get a theory like quantum mechanics with insufficient cause, then the two pictures are very different.
I agree.
Do you have in mind stochastic theories or even more general, even less cause?
Well, the theory I have in mind is quantum mechanics, which is a theory of insufficient cause.
I agree with what you're saying, but even then, at least for classical stochastical theories with objective chance and randomly happening events without any cause, this can also be modeled in that there is this whole theory of branching spacetimes.
Well, that's hardly a block universe.
Well, it's a stochastic version of the block universe.
Well, I know that Hugh has something relevant to say because we've had this fight many times, but
But Hans already has the microphone.
Oh, yeah. I can speak louder now. So I'd like to contest Josufink's answer to if there could be any conceivable difference between a block universe and a time-evolving universe. And he answered, well, the question was, can any block universe theory be written as a time-evolving one? And the answer was trivially yes, according to you. But I would say that we already have an example like general relativity where the answer is trivially no. I mean, if you have globally, well, space-time which is not globally hyperbolic, like, for example, curved space-time, which is describing rotating black holes, or the Gödel universe, and these are exact solutions, then you cannot understand Einstein general relativity as a succession of events. You have to understand it as a block universe, and there is no Cauchy initial value data formulation of the theory. So in here, I would say that there is a, you know, already known conventional theory when the answer is just no.
I'm not sure whether the equivalence that I was trying to describe depends on the existence of Cauchy data. Why not? They don't have to progress in step at every location. So they might, as long as there's some sequence of nows along every world line, even if these world lines end up into black holes, or for my case, perhaps I don't care if they end up in causal loops in a Gödel universe or so, that is not inconsistent with having this progression.
Oh, I just wanted to really agree with Jos's response to Bill about the claim that there was a connection between determinism, indeterminism, and the block universe. I mean, I think it's very easy to imagine very simple block universes which are indeterministic. I mean, I'll describe one now. There's Newtonian space and time. There's nothing in the world except a particle which comes into existence for about 10 minutes at some point. There's no law which tells you when it's going to come into existence. It's an indeterministic universe, but nevertheless, there's a perfectly good block description of the entire history of that universe.
Well, you have to only after it's happened.
No. There's a description which is true beforehand. We don't know it, of course. Well, we're not there at all, so we're not there to know it. But the facts are there, laid out in the block, just as they are in a deterministic block. They're just not predictable, but that's a different issue.
Yeah, and if I may add something, it's kind of the same with Brownian motion. Now, for a change, it's not Bohmian motion. So you could either regard that as a random curve in space-time, or you can regard that as a stochastic process as time evolves and it makes new decisions about in which direction to move next. Why isn't that an example?
No, but I think until it has moved, until it has carried out its motion, you have no idea of how to describe this thing in a block universe form. After everything, I mean, the block universe being equivalent to the time development universe is, of course, trivial if all we ever look at is the past. So, you know, the past is frozen no matter which one of these formulations we take. So, of course, the block universe and any other thing is equivalent as long as we look in the past. But the interesting thing happens if we're looking into the future. Are the two the same looking into the future? And I don't think they are for a system with insufficient cause.
This morning, but I was describing what I called asynchronous becoming at the end of the talk, and it seemed to me that you're talking about the same thing. But I also gave a very concrete model in which I think it's easier to see why that's a real option than it is in the case of continuum relativity. It's a discrete growth model, and there's a very definite sense in which things happen, elements are born, but there's an equally definite sense in which by a gauge invariance that you build in, it's meaningless to ask whether a birth here happened before or after a birth in a space-like separated location. Yeah. So you would say it is the same idea?
Yeah.
Okay, but, well, I think the natives are getting restless, and we're near pub night, and we can always continue. The questions, we only went through a small fraction of them. I think that I'll actually type them in and get them posted on the web page just so everyone can think about these good questions and remember this conference with fondness, I hope. Thank you all for coming. I think I'll actually type all of these in and just...